Why does it seem that fake stories have so much more traction than the truth?
Studies show that we actually are prone to pass on stories that we may not think are true, but we pass them on because they're exciting and interesting, or they because of a craving for social media acceptance. Another study shows that false stories travel around the world at a greater rate than the truth can ever keep up.
That's Stephen Davis. We talk with him about his book, Truth Teller, an investigative reporter's journey through the world of truth prevention, fake news, and conspiracy theories. Then, why do we love murder mysteries so much?
One of the great pleasures of reading a whodunit is that you get everything in the last chapter resolved. And in a world which is now full of uncertainty, full of fake news, where we really do not know where we are from morning until night, I think there is great comfort to be had in a book that dots all the I's and crosses all the T's and leaves everything resolved.
That's mystery maven Anthony Horowitz. We talk with him about his new book, The Sentence is Death. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Donald Trump attacks news outlets all the time with accusations of fake news. But Trump and his servile right-wing media spread fact-free stories and conspiracy theories all the time. And they aren't the only ones. Corporations and governments, foreign and domestic, do it. So do ordinary folks on social media. How can we discern the truth through the billowing clouds of lies that muck up our media spaces? That's something my guest Stephen Davis sets out to teach us in his book, Truth Teller. He exposes the deception, cover-ups, and alternate realities we're barraged with from those who want to keep the truth hidden. It's something he's intimately familiar with through his experience as an investigative journalist. Among those who have tried to dissuade him from reporting his stories are men with Kalashnikovs, government lawyers, corporate PRs in fancy suits, senior police officers, billionaires, and newspaper owners. Stephen Davis worked for the Sunday Times and the Independent, as well as 60 Minutes, 2020, the Discovery Channel, and the BBC. He's taught journalism to thousands of students from all over the world and won multiple awards for his investigative reporting. Well, Stephen Davis, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Truth Teller, this is a very timely book, I would say, at this time of the assault on truth, this so-called post-truth era. You have had a long career as a journalist, and I just wanted to start out by asking you a little bit about how you have kind of accrued the knowledge about this over the years. I mean, did you start out just knowing as a green reporter that you were going to face the kind of manipulation that you've come into, or was this something that has really developed over time for you?
Well, interestingly enough, I always wanted to be a journalist. I have a school report written when I was 10 years old saying, Stephen wants to be a journalist, but will need to improve his English. I'm still working on that, but obviously. I became a junior reporter. I remember working on a newspaper in New Zealand and going to watch All the President's Men three times the day it came out, the Redford Hoffman movie about Woodward and Bernstein. And I had this tremendously idealistic idea about what journalism can achieve. And I've kept the idealism, but gradually over 30 years of reporting and investigative reporting, I've become very concerned at two things, really. One is that the amount of in-depth journalism that goes on is in decline. And this is happening alongside a huge increase in the volumes of disinformation and misinformation circulating around the world. So much of the disinformation and misinformation flooding around the world makes it easier than ever for politicians and dictators and corporations to lie and deceive. And I became particularly alarmed because I've taught journalism students all over the world. And each year I would give them a test, and the test would be an online research exercise in which they were required to distinguish between factual information and non-factual information. And each year the numbers failing the test has gone up.
And it seems every day we have another example of the deepening of that. I mean, just, you know, a few days ago, there was a video of Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, that was slowed down to 75%. And, you know, it's curious. I watched that video, and to me, it was obvious it was a fake. But to millions of other people, it seems like it was not obvious. And Facebook has refused to actually take it down, although they say that they label it as a fake. What do you think of that?
So Facebook is now the world's most socially irresponsible company, in my view. For years, they have managed to convince people that they ought not to be treated for what they are, which is a publisher and a broadcaster. Media organizations and newspapers and even corporations in their annual report are responsible for what they say. Facebook says, no, we're not responsible, even though it appears on our platform, even though in all respects we are a publisher and a broadcaster. And this has got to change because they have neglected to fulfill the social role which a company of their size and power should. You can't tell me that they can't fix this stuff. If you and I go on Facebook for a few seconds and type in a few words, the algorithm immediately sends us a tailored ad. But in the meantime, they are just shrugging their shoulders. That's what they've done with the Nancy Pelosi video, shrug their shoulders. It's not our responsibility. The equivalent would be if the New York Times published a fake story and people put, you know, challenged them about it, and it shrugged their shoulders saying, oh, no, it's all political debate and we can't do anything about it. So, you know, Facebook's got to be forced to be responsible, and it's got to be forced to be responsible long before many worse things come into play, because I began Truth Teller, my research for Truth Teller, as an optimist, and I ended as a pessimist. And however bad the situation is now, in the next 10 years, it's going to get worse because the technology of deepfakes and artificial intelligence will allow even more deceptions to come online. And I have to say, Francesca, that Americans, and I've spoken to quite a few American journalists now as part of promoting my book, even though you have the Trump issue and a president who apparently can't help himself lying, you're actually a little bit complacent about it. Because the tendency is to point the finger just at a few political issues and say that's the only problem, whereas the problem is simply a torrent, an unimaginable quantity of misinformation circulating online about health and medicine and science and all other kinds of social issues, which millions of people are believing to the detriment of society.
Yeah, you know, you have a quote by Timothy Snyder, and we interviewed him for this show on Writer's Voice, that really points to the stakes, you know, what is at stake. You quote him, he says, "Believe in truth. To abandon facts is to abandon freedom. If nothing is true, then no one can criticize power because there's no basis on which to do so." Why did you put that right at the front's piece?
Because I think that this level of misinformation and disinformation is actually the most serious threat to Western liberal democracy, more of a serious threat than any dictator with guns. Because if we lose the ability to distinguish truth from fiction, and if it becomes so easy to lie to us, we won't be able to make informed judgments or decisions as members of society. And what's interesting about this stuff is there are now techniques of deception, as I describe in Truth Teller, that are shared and used by dictators and by elected politicians in the West. And I'll give you an example. There's a technique called the big lie, and that's based on the way our brains work. Our brains are kind of wired to accept as trustworthy information that we hear frequently, like from our friends and colleagues. The more we hear it, the more we trust it. So Trump will tell a big lie, initially, very few people might believe them. But they tell it again and again and again, and you can track the numbers going up. It ought to be remembered that Trump made his bones in the Republican Party with the Obama birther conspiracy theory. And when he first floated this, he was disowned by the mainstream Republican Party, and polls showed, you know, the numbers of Republican voters who believed him was in single figures. And after 2 years of repeating it endlessly, telling this big lie and repeating it again and again, and getting other people to repeat it, the numbers believing it were over 50%. So the technique works. It's used by dictators and it's used by electorate politicians. And this is just a small sample of what we're facing in the future. I really think that the disinformation crisis is like a public health emergency. It's like the Ebola virus, only it's more likely to kill society.
You know, most of the cases that you talk about in this book, and it is really a terrific book, Truth Teller, Stephen Davis, are cases that involve the truth being suppressed or distorted about events that actually happened. But, you know, as you point out, there are the ones that are made up and the events that are made up. And one of the examples you give is the case of the FBI agents Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. These were FBI agents investigating Russian interference in the 2016 election. Surprise, surprise. What happened to them and the so-called secret society?
So these two agents share something which very obviously is a joke. I mean, you can tell it's a joke. And this is seized on by the press and by the president and amplified and has a feedback mechanism, of course, using Fox News and other people, and turned into some major conspiracy that there was a plot to undermine Trump and not the Russians interfering with the election. Of course, the whole absurdity of this, anybody looking at it logically simply has to ask themselves this question. The FBI knew before the election about links between the Trump campaign and the Russians. They were already investigating it. If, of course, they had wanted to damage Donald Trump's chance of being president, they simply would have leaked it to the press. Instead, they said nothing and kept it secret. And in fact, the only thing they ended up telling the press was that they were reopening the investigation of Hillary's emails. So in fact, the only public things that the FBI did in 2016 were to damage Hillary Clinton's chances to the benefit of Donald Trump, and not to say anything which they could have done about Trump's links to the Russians. So it's the complete opposite of a group acting to undermine the presidency.
And what was the role of bots in that and the creation of other deceptions?
Very interestingly, I had gone several times to lecture at the University of Missouri School of Journalism, which is the oldest journalism school, I think, in the world. And I'd visited the town in Missouri where it's based, and it struck me as being a very pleasant, quiet college town, very little difficulties. And I was shocked a while later to discover there had been an outbreak of racial tension on campus. And it turned in, the world's press descended, and it turned into quite a big story. Now, if you track what happened in this, somebody published a picture of a young black boy who had been badly beaten and said he had been beaten up on the campus at Missouri. Subsequently, there was a story circulated that the Ku Klux Klan was coming to Missouri to demonstrate. And sure enough, eventually there was aggravation and demonstration on campus. But the whole thing was a fake. The photograph had been lifted from an unrelated incident in Philadelphia. The Ku Klux Klan were never coming to town, or indeed in the town. And you trace the source of this, and it was a Russian bot from an outfit based in St. Petersburg. And as I say in my book, in Truth Teller, I then trace the actions of the same group who were responsible for spreading a lot of stories in Britain before Brexit stories which were anti-immigration and were designed to inflame the vote. So here is a very small group of people, probably not even a very expensive operation in Russia, who have managed to disrupt Western democracy in two very significant ways.
Yeah, and one thing that always puzzles me is, why do people fall for these things? And then I have to remember, actually, you know, when the whole Pizzagate thing happened, I remember thinking that was utterly absurd and outlandish. I mean, the whole notion that Hillary Clinton was a pedophile and ran a pedophile ring was you know, beyond unbelievable. And yet there was this little voice of doubt in me like, well, what if it's true?
Yeah, the Pizzagate thing is very interesting. And I've been tracking, I've actually got a contract for a new book, and I've been tracking the QAnon movement around the world. The QAnon movement were the people who propagated the Pizzagate theory, as you know. And they're completely immune to facts, of course. At one stage, they said children were held in the basement and the restaurant doesn't have a basement. But the problem with this is a couple of issues here. One is that studies show that we actually are prone to pass on stories that we may not think are true, but we pass them on because they're exciting and interesting, or they because of a craving for social media acceptance. Another study shows that false stories travel around the world at a greater rate than the truth can ever keep up. And of course, the other thing is, and which I have relayed to you know, a lot in my book, is conspiracy theories. People like them. People think they're intriguing and interesting and not harmful. My argument is they are profoundly harmful and profoundly dangerous, and people ought not to pass them on. What you and I might think is something crazy and a joke, it only needs one young man, disgruntled young man, you know, living in his mother's basement with access to weapons, to believe this stuff is real, for it to cause, you know, genuine harm. And in my home country of New Zealand, we have seen that tragically recently, where an Australian who was a believer in the replacement conspiracy theory, who had access to guns, went and murdered a lot of people in a mosque.
A replacement theory?
Yes. So this is another interesting thing about conspiracy theories, kind of shapeshifters. They're used by different people for different reasons around the world. There is a very persistent anti-NGO conspiracy theory, by the way, NGOs being non-governmental organizations. Putin tells his people in Russia that Western NGOs are part of a secret plot to bring Western values in to damage Russia. Erdogan in Turkey tells his people the same thing. The Christchurch gunman believed another version of the NGO theory, which is the NGOs who were helping those poor, unfortunate people fleeing Syria and other hellholes to get across the Mediterranean in boats into Europe, were part of a secret plot. And the secret plot was to get as many Muslims into Europe as possible so they could have as many babies as possible, so eventually they would overpower and replace the white man. That's the replacement theory. And incidentally, the exact theory was shared by a Norwegian mass killer called Anders Breivik, who also believed the same thing and went and murdered lots of people.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Stephen Davis about his book, Truth Teller, An Investigative Reporter's Journey Through the World of Truth Prevention, Fake News, and Conspiracy Theories. You know, it's interesting. I heard an interview with an author of another book on conspiracy theories, and she pointed out that another reason why they are believed is because there have, you know, governments do in fact lie. There have been in fact conspiracies. In this very book, Truth Teller, Stephen Davis, you give some cases of where, you know, governments have conspired to keep the truth. And we all know that, I mean, from the Iraq War. So I'd like to turn to some of those official cases of misinformation. One that really leaped out to me was character assassination, because I remember years ago when I interviewed Peter Galbraith, who was an expert and a diplomat and an expert on the Kurds who opposed the Iraq War, was set up with, you know, allegations that he was a pedophile, which seems to be one of the favorite tactics. So I wonder if you could talk about this notion of, you know, of how character assassination is used and how you used it as an example in your book.
Yeah, I can give you a personal example and then an example involving somebody else. I have written a number of stories, and in the book, The Tale of the Human Shields of the First Gulf War, the people who were taken hostage in, by Saddam Hussein, and the reason why some of them were landed in a war zone. When a question was asked in Parliament by an MP to the then British Defence Minister, Jeff Hoon, about this, Hoon batted it away. And at the end of it, he said to the MP, "I need a private conversation with you." So they have a private conversation. And Hoon, the government minister, said to the MP, "You've got to be very careful of this Stephen Davis. I hear," he said, notice the word "I hear," passing on, you know, not that he's saying it, "but I hear that he's a bit of a fantasist." Well, when the MP told me this, after I had finished laughing, I thought, that was very rich coming from a representative of a government which produced the totally fantastical weapons of mass destruction dossier that led Britain to join the war in Iraq. The other example in the book, I interviewed a former British intelligence officer called Richard Tomlinson. I actually got him on camera. It was the first MI6 officer to speak out on camera about things he was concerned about. The British government pursued him ruthlessly around the world. They had the French police arrest him and beat him up. They had the Italian police chase him and beat him up. At one stage, he was trying to settle in Switzerland, and they told the Swiss police that he was a paedophile, which was completely and utterly untrue. So character assassination is one of the main methods which, if the governments can't easily refute the story, they will go after the source or they will go after the reporter.
And then there's flat-out intimidation. In the chapter Shoot the Messengers, it's absolutely terrifying. You went to the Amazon, to the Jamari National Forest. Tell us why you went there and what did you discover? And why were you, did you feel so much in danger?
Yeah, this is of great concern to me because of an up-to-date part of the issue. But yeah, we were told when I was on the Sunday Times in London that BP, the world's largest oil company, owned a mining operation, a large mining operation in the Amazon, which was destroying huge amounts of the Amazon rainforest. We mounted what was one of the world's first serious environmental investigations. All we knew in total was that BP owned a mine somewhere in the Amazon. As you know, the Amazon is bigger than Western Europe. I went to Brazil, spent weeks and weeks trying to find this mine. Finally, with the help of some Brazilian Forestry Service officials, and dressed myself as a Brazilian Forestry Service official undercover, I have to say, not my best fashion look, think Boy Scout uniform. We got to the mine, which was guarded by armed men who were very threatening. My mate, the Forestry Service official, talked his way past the armed guards by engaging the guard in a conversation about football, which the Brazilians are passionate about. I get into the mine. It's astonishing. It's like the surface of the moon. I managed to take a photo, which we smuggled out. The mining had caused the water runoff, had poisoned the local water supply. It was an astonishing story. I came back. We exposed BP. It was a huge international story. I think the Sunday Times nominated it as one of the investigative stories of the decade. But back in Brazil, the Brazilian government, which was pro-mining, tracked down the Forestry Service officials who helped me, ordinary working men, and sacked them. They lost their jobs. And it was, you know, it was an outrage. The other disturbing thing about this story, Francesca, in researching the book, I have gone back now to talk to people in that same area of the Amazon. So there's two things to say about this. One is, I don't think any news organization, no matter how wealthy, would mount an investigation like this now, with its costs that it entailed, on that little amount of information. So you may never have found out about the story if it happened now. But the second disturbing thing is, now we've kind of all forgotten about the Amazon rainforest and moved on. It turns out that the level of rainforest destruction in this area is as bad as it ever was. And the new Brazilian president, who makes Donald Trump look like a weak-kneed liberal, has recently changed the rules to make it easier to destroy rainforest. So, you know, now we live in a world where investigations like that wouldn't be done, but the problem hasn't gone away. The destruction of the rainforest hasn't gone away just because we've stopped reading about it.
And deforestation is a major contributor to climate change, and the Amazon forest is the lungs of the planet. So, yeah, it's dire.
Absolutely. And very interesting about climate change, I must tell you, I have done a book tour in Australia, and I talked to a lot of radio hosts in Queensland. I don't know whether you know Australia, but Queensland is kind of, I guess, the Australian equivalent of Alabama, if you will. And all of these radio hosts, when we were talking about conspiracy theories, they would suddenly ask me, oh, what about climate change? And I'd kind of pause because, you know, you're trying to promote the book and you can't really insult the person who's interviewing you. But I would pause and just very carefully say, well, I think the science is pretty sound on that. But they were all obsessed with it. And then I had another host ask me about the moon landing. She said, what do you think of the moon landing? Wasn't that faked? I said, you mean Apollo 11? And she said, yes. And I said, okay, pausing quickly, trying to think what I should say. And then I said, if you think Apollo 11 was faked, what about Apollo 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17? Because man landed on the moon six different times. And do you think all six were faked or just the first one? The interesting thing about it is she didn't know that man had landed on the moon six times. And bless her, she actually went away saying, oh, perhaps I should look at this again. But, you know, all joking aside, it is really disturbing that kind of mainstream radio hosts in a large place in a Western democracy are believing this crazy nonsense. And of course, then their listeners are believing this crazy nonsense.
Right. And certainly in the face of the evidence, I mean, Australia has had the most catastrophic fire seasons in its history.
Yeah, the whole place is burning up. I mean, if you want, it's got all the evidence. I worked in Australia for 5 years and I found it too hot actually to live there most of the time. And it's even worse now.
Yeah, so with all this, you know, and we've only touched the surface, you have many other cases in the book, in the toolbox, in your book about the toolbox of deception and how that works. You teach journalism. What can the ordinary reader, the ordinary listener do to distinguish what's fake and what's not?
Yeah, I think that in the next 10 years, media literacy courses are going to be right up there as essential teaching at every level, from young people through to adults, to teach people to be ethical consumers and sharers of information. It's not good enough, by the way. We all must take responsibility. It's not good enough to say, okay, I shared a fake story, but I didn't originate it. You know, like the getaway driver saying, I just drove them away from the bank robbery. I didn't rob the bank. Everybody has to take individual responsibility to be an ethical consumer and sharer of information. I've actually designed a new course for the University of Otago in New Zealand, but it's going to be open to students worldwide to learn about this stuff. I also teach my journalism students about it. Interestingly enough, young people, we constantly say how social media savvy they are, and they are in terms of using it. But, you know, they're not social media savvy in terms of working out what information they can trust or not. Many of them, for instance, believe that reality TV is real. And I'll run a clip of a reality TV, and I'll say, imagine the camera. How many cameras do they have there? This person looking, reacting to that other person. Were the three cameras recording it contemporaneously? No, of course not. it was faked up afterwards, the reaction after they moved the camera. But, you know, many young people believe this stuff is real. And even though they know how to use social media, they're slightly lost in what is credible and what is not. And of course, young people are also, as polls show, losing faith in democracy as the best form of government. So if they lose faith in democracy, the adults and leaders of the future, and they lose the ability to distinguish what's real and what's not, we're really heading for disaster. So I think education is the answer. I love the old H.G. Wells quote. H.G. Wells said, "History is a race between education and catastrophe." I think we have to have widespread media literacy education.
Well, that sounds great. But going into this here in this country, going into our extremely long election season, could you leave us with one or two tips as we try to separate fact from fiction in reading the news?
Okay. The old saying, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is, should be your guide. If you hear or see a story which seems really amazing and interesting, but it's only appearing on one site or from one source, you should not pass that on. Secondly, develop a list of media organizations you can trust and base every decision you make on sharing information on multi-sourcing. And this is not, by the way, a left wing or right wing. I often get asked, how do you learn to trust a media organization? Well, here's one of my criteria. A media organization which will own up to its mistakes, I think, is one you can trust. A media organization which covers up its mistakes is one that you don't trust. And finally, understand that politicians have been taught and trained, of all stripes, by the way, Democratic or Republican, to avoid the tough questions and to try and get their points across by cutting out the middleman being the journalist asking the tough questions. So you might look at the social media clip of the politician, their Facebook post. That's public relations. If you want to see how they handle the truth, watch them being questioned by a proper professional journalist. Then you'll get a better understanding of it.
And so many of those proper professional journalists have started to soft pedal their questions in the face of a lot of pushback. But that's good advice. I also go to the actual record of the politician. So there are some sites, you know, that I go to just to find out whether what they're saying now is what they actually did in the past.
Absolutely. Yes. Check the record. That's another very good one.
Well, this has been fascinating talking with you, Stephen Davis, about your book, Truth Teller, An Investigative Reporter's Journey Through the World of Truth Prevention, Fake News, and Conspiracy Theories. Thanks for speaking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks, Francesca.
Stephen Davis. Go to writersvoice.net to see video stories from incidents he writes about in Truth Teller. Next up, we talk with famed mystery novelist Anthony Horowitz about his newest in his series of mystery metafiction about Detective Daniel Hawthorne. Stay with us. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Anthony Horowitz is nothing if not prolific. He's the best-selling author of, among many others, Magpie Murders, House of Silk, Moriarty, and the Alex Rider series, as well as the TV crime dramas Foyle's War and Midsummer Murders. We last talked with Horowitz about his James Bond novel, Forever in a Day, and before that, the first in a series of meta-mystery fiction featuring Detective Daniel Hawthorne. The word is murder. I say meta-mystery fiction because the series also features the author, Anthony Horowitz, as a main character. In the first book, and now the second, The Sentence is Death, Horowitz uses himself as a character to discuss the inner workings of writing detective fiction, as well as to riff on the genre's tropes. It's all done with playful wit and page-turning suspense. Well, Anthony Horowitz, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure to be here again, Francesca. Thank you.
So, The Sentence is Death. This is the second in a series. The first was The Word is Murder. It's featuring you as a kind of modern-day Watson to a modern-day Holmes. His name is Daniel Hawthorne. Tell us about Daniel Hawthorne first and how you met him, figuratively speaking.
Well, within the book, the idea is that he was a detective once who has been fired from Scotland Yard for reasons that aren't clear, to begin with anyway, and comes and works on one of my television shows as a consultant. And that's how we first meet. And as a result of that, he knows who I am and what I do. And then a couple of years later, because he needs extra money, he gets this idea in his head that he's going to hire a writer to write up his investigations, his cases. In other words, as you correctly say, to be the Watson to his Holmes. And he rather forcibly persuades me to become that character. And so I end up following him around London on sort of bizarre murder investigations.
And is he based on anyone that you actually know or some composite?
He's based on a character I sort of wrote in a show some years ago. I wrote a detective series which had an actor called Charlie Creed Miles in it. And he played a detective who, in fact, got killed at the end of the show. And I always rather regretted losing him because he was such a good character and a great performance as well. The show was called Injustice. It has James Purfoy in it, too. And the character of Hawthorne is sort of based on that character created at that time.
Hmm. And he's brought in to this, this investigation and the one in the previous book precisely because he doesn't operate like modern detectives. What's the difference between how he operates and how so much detecting is done these days?
Well, he is, in a way, he is an intuitive modern version of Sherlock Holmes. There's a lot of Holmes in him, including, incidentally, the slightly unpleasantness of his character, the coldness of him, the fact that he and I don't get on particularly well. In fact, ours is not a relationship like Holmes and Watson. Watson is a great admirer of Holmes, whereas I find Hawthorne extremely difficult for all sorts of reasons, some of his attitudes, for example. But what I like writing about when I deal with this character is his ability to make deductions. In other words, he uses old-fashioned methods of thinking and deducing and finding clues and finding patterns in the crime rather than forensic science, door-to-door investigation, modern procedural detective work. That I find much less interesting. I mean, I'm not knocking it. Of course, there are many great books and great TV shows that have that as their basis, but I'm interested in much more in, if you like, reinventing the sort of golden age of crime fiction where so much of what is done is cerebral and done sort of almost from the armchair.
And was that ever, or do you think that that actually is a valid way of doing detecting in the real world?
Well, I think it's something I've written about quite a lot, including in the Hawthorne books and in Magpie Murders, an earlier book I wrote, which was about exactly that. In modern-day reality, if somebody commits a murder, they are caught pretty much immediately, nearly always, because if you think about it, there's CCTV everywhere. Forensic science is now so smart and so clever. And if you kill somebody without actually, going through the Agatha Christie-style machinations of thinking about it, if you kill someone in a fit of anger or rage or even with a little bit of moderate planning, you're still going to leave so much clues behind. You're going to leave fingerprints and DNA and you might have blood splatter on your clothes. That is how crimes are solved. As I say, I think I've read somewhere that a very, very high percentage of crimes are solved in the first 24 hours, which is great if you are a law-abiding citizen, but not so great if you're wanting the fun and the adventure of a whodunit.
That's true. And now about you, what is it like being a character in your own book?
Well, it's interesting that my family, when they heard this idea, were absolutely horrified, especially my wife, Jill, who turns up in both books briefly. And they were worried about lots of things, that I might use the books for promotion or some kind of boasting about my work or whatever, or to settle scores and everything, but it might seem like sort of self-promotion. And I do have to make it very clear that I am very much the narrator. The books are not about me. They're about Hawthorne and my attempts to find out about him. So I am very much a minor character in these books. But what I think is fun is that I have turned the whodunit on its head, because instead of being the cleverest person in the book, which of course Agatha Christie is in an Agatha Christie book, or Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is in a Sherlock Holmes adventure, they know everything from the very start. I know nothing. I am completely at the mercy of Hawthorne. If he doesn't solve the crime, I don't even have a book. And I rather enjoy this sort of very peculiar angle of writing about crime in that way. And it is also enjoyable for me to be able to write about writing, to be able to write about why we read detective fiction, why murder appears in so much literature, and to look at the sort of the whole role of the writer. I have, after all, been writing for pretty much four decades now. I mean, a very, very long time. So I'm also having fun writing about writing.
Yes, and I want to get back to that. But still on you, you're a little too modest, I think. I think you're a larger presence in this book, possibly, than the last one. In this one, the sentence is death, because you are determined, you say in this book, to solve the case yourself. That's about as meta as they come. And actually, you do have to solve the cases yourself every time you write a book.
Well, of course, when I write a book, I'm not solving the case, I'm creating the case. In these books, I'm trying to solve the case with not, I have to say, fantastic results. But you are right. Yes, I think that what's happened in this second book, The Sentence is Death, is that the relationship with Hawthorne, it's always the way, when you write the first book, you're setting everything up. I mean, look at Study in Scarlet and the Doyle novels. When you're setting up your characters, you have a lot of legwork to do to sort of say whoever everybody is and how they relate to each other. But once that's been established, you have much more opportunity to enjoy the characters. So I enjoy much more about Hawthorne and discover some of his secrets, though not all of them. But I think I also, you're right, do enjoy being in the mystery myself, and the relationship I have with both Hawthorne and with the investigating police. And my sort of haplessness as a sort of an investigator is something that makes me smile. So I mean, what I was trying to say earlier was that I am not trying to be center stage. I think that my role is a sidekick, and it is important to say that because, you know, I don't think in fiction or in reality that I am as interesting as any character I can create.
Yes, and yet it is in the first person.
It is my voice, yeah. Although if you listen to the audiobook read by Rory Kinnear, I gasp in amazement at how he has captured me and everybody else in his own way. It's very odd to hear myself and my voice coming out of somebody else's mouth. But yes, it's my voice and a lot of my attitudes, but as I say, I'm not the one in control.
Now, you mentioned before, why is murder in so much literature? Why is murder in so much literature?
Well, murder is a wonderful device for a writer. Whether, you know, every writer, you know, great and small, Shakespeare and Dickens put murders into their books, and there's a whole industry based on murder. I think the answer is this, is that if you want to connect two people in a way that is very profound and begs many, many questions, one of them murdering the other is really the easiest, fastest, and most enjoyable way to do it. As soon as A has murdered B, you are invested in both of them. What was it that B did? Why was he deserving of his murder? And why did A take it upon himself at great risk to commit that deed? And then from there, you get almost a spider's network of connections as to who is A? I mean, is he the wife? Is he the husband, the father, the mother, the sister, the brother, the business partner? Who is that person, and what is the motivation? So a murder begs a story. And I also think that a whodunit provides answers. One of the great pleasures of reading a whodunit is that you get everything in the last chapter resolved. And in a world that is now full of uncertainty, full of fake news, where we really do not know where we are from morning until night, I think there is great comfort to be had in a book that dots all the I's and crosses all the T's and leaves everything resolved.
And it certainly does in this book, Anthony Horowitz, in The Sentence's Death. You know, I have to compliment you on your haiku. Tell us about the title and the haiku it's based on.
Well, funnily enough, the original title of the book was going to be Another Word for Murder. Mm. And my publishers didn't like that title because they thought it sounded too much like a sequel. But if you, it occurred to me when I was writing it that Another Word for Murder had seven syllables in it, and the thought immediately popped into my head that it could be the middle line of a haiku. And I've always had a fascination with haikus. I say it in the book that when I was young, they were the sort of poetry I liked because they were so short. Given the choice of a haiku or you know, 300 pages of Paradise Lost or Don Juan or something, I went for the haiku because I wasn't a great reader. When my publisher told me to change the title and we came up with The Sentence is Death, that fortunately has five syllables in it, so it could be either the first or the third line of a haiku, which is what it is. And that then led me to the whole sort of subplot of the book and the character of Akira Ano, whom I adored writing, incidentally, the literary writer who has produced this book called, I think, 200 Haikus. And I just sort of immediately knew her because writing haikus is so far away from what I do in my world that I knew I would be creating a writer who was as different from me as it was possible to be.
Yeah, so talk about this marvelous character, Akira Ano, and maybe just give us a taste of the plot here.
Well, Akira Ano is a sort of a... if I say that she's a feminist writer, I don't use that word pejoratively. As I say in the book, a great many of my friends are indeed feminist writers, and I admire them very much. But she is a feminist writer who takes herself incredibly seriously and who is very, very short in the book with me because I am a commercial writer, and she somewhat disdains, I think, murder mysteries and detective stories and popular fiction of any sort. I've met one or two people like that as well. And she is also, incidentally, the main suspect in the story because only the main character who's been killed is a divorce lawyer who's been clubbed to death with a bottle of wine. And only days before this happened, she had threatened to do exactly that, more or less, in a restaurant in London. So she's both the number one suspect. She is very antagonistic towards me. I'm not too fond of her either. But as I say, I had enormous fun creating her and finding myself fighting with her.
And she writes for Virago Imprint. I thought that was a nice touch.
Well, of course she would, wouldn't she? Yes.
So was that a chance to skewer literary pretensions in her character?
I don't think I'm going that far in these books. I mean, you know, I'm a great fan of literary fiction, and I think, you know, it's great that it's there and that it can still exist in a world where, you know, airports and high street shops, the windows at least, are full of sort of the latest blockbusters. You know, we need literary fiction, and I greatly admire writers who do that. But at the same time, I think there is a code amongst writers. Writing is writing. Whether you are writing a masterpiece or you are writing a light entertainment, we are all a family. And I have occasionally, very, very occasionally, met writers like Akira Ano who have that sort of attitude of because my books sell fewer copies than yours, because they are more difficult to read, they are somehow better or somehow more superior. You know what I mean? I'm not a competitive person myself. As I say, I think that writers are all on the same level. We're all one. But when I come across that pretentiousness, that's what I want to skewer, not necessarily literary writing.
Yeah, and I'm curious that you said that when you were a kid, you were not a reader. I mean, I thought you have to be a reader to be a good writer, and you're a wonderful writer.
Well, you're very kind to say it, and I appreciate that. Thank you. The truth is that I was a slow developer. I mean, I didn't read an awful lot when I was young, like sort of 8 to 12, I found books difficult. The first book I loved was Tintin. Tintin is a graphic novel. It's pictures with balloons and speech bubbles. So, you know, I still love those books, incidentally, and I loved the characters and the world of it, and they very much inspired my writing. I think the first books I read were by a man called Willard Price. Wonderful books, again, adventure stories, but very light, very sort of adventure-driven, not particularly what you would call great writing in any way, although I think they are very great books. It took me a long time to get into what you might call literature, to get into, to sort of climb that mountain. I've always believed, instead, that reading, like writing, is an adventure. It's a journey. You can start in the foothills, but if you choose to do so, there are mountains out there. These days, I love Trollope, I love Dickens, I love great novels, but it was a long, slow journey to rise up those slopes into great books. So it is true that when I was young, my three great loves, Tintin, Sherlock Holmes, and James Bond, they've all been huge influences in my life, but it took me a long time to really get that reading bug going.
And when and how did you discover that you are a writer?
Well, that was very early on. I was at a horrible boarding school. I was the fat kid. I was the stupid kid. I was the unpopular kid. I was the kid who couldn't sort of... I had no self-confidence at all. I mean, I was told so often that I was a waste of space that I believed it. And first of all, it was reading Tintin and Willard Price led me into a love, at least, of story. And then I began to tell stories to the other children. So aged about 10, this is a boarding school. I'm in a dormitory, so there are 8 kids to a room in these little metal beds, and it's cold and it's dark, and there is an atmosphere of abuse and bullying in this private school. Anybody who knows anything about English private education in the 60s will know what I'm talking about. And in the darkness, I start to tell the other kids stories. And for the first time in my life, I'm accepted. And I also realize for the first time in my life that unlike everything I've been told, I do have a talent, and that talent is for telling stories, and I've been doing it ever since.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with mystery writer Anthony Horowitz about his latest crime novel, The Sentence is Death. And you write several books at the same time, is that true?
No, it isn't true, actually. I tend to have, I mean, as I sit here now, I'm writing Magpie Murders number 2, the sequel to that book, which is going to be my next novel. And in fact, you rang me just without getting the end of chapter 2, so I mean, it's very early stages. And I'm also writing a 6-part television series. I try never to work on 2 projects in the same day, but I occasionally work on 2 projects in the same week. I tend not to write 2 novels at the same time because novels, particularly something like Magpie Murders, which is, you know, it's going to be 150,000 words, and it's incredibly complicated to construct the story. I couldn't possibly run 2 major storylines in my head at the same time. So I have to separate them. Television and a book, that's enough separation.
Now, there are many ways in which you talk in this book, in The Word is Murder. In The Sentence is Death, and also in The Word is Murder. You talk about the genre, how the sausage is made. I came across a term you used here that I think I vaguely heard of, but I have no idea what it is. What is a pathetic fallacy?
The pathetic fallacy, which is at the end of The Sentence is Death, it's a writer, I've always loved that. The word pathetic fallacy is a wonderful description of something. And what it describes is where a writer uses the weather to set the mood for the chapter. If you remember Peanuts, the dog in Peanuts, Snoopy, was always writing a book, and it always began, it was a dark and stormy night. That's the pathetic fallacy, where immediately you set up a certain mood, a dark and stormy night, something dark and stormy is going to happen in the story. And the fun of my book is that at the end of it, I am persuaded not to resign from writing the book by a pathetic fallacy. You actually see it sort of happen inside the book. I'm actually creating the weather, even though I'm pretending that I'm affected by it. So if that makes any sense at all to your listeners, I have no idea, but that's what's going on.
So I get the pathetic because that comes from pathos, so I guess that's mood, but why fallacy?
Well, a fallacy is a misunderstanding. Is that correct? Is that the correct term?
Yeah. Well,
I guess it's because at the end of the day, it is not true. Just because at the moment it is grey and miserable and wet in London doesn't mean that our conversation is not cheerful, I hope, and positive and enjoyable. So it is a fallacy to suggest that the weather affects our mood to that extent or affects the events in a narrative. So I don't know who thought it up, but it's a wonderful description of something which writers do use, and I've used it all the time. I mean, when I'm writing a book, I'm always thinking, what is the weather like in this chapter? And I'm quite careful sometimes to avoid the pathetic fallacy. So, for example, if I'm writing a scary scene, I will not put a flash of lightning and a crash of thunder in it because that becomes cliched. I mean, and many, you know, most pathetic fallacy does tend to have cliché behind it. So, you know, but none that said, you know, I will occasionally, you know, use fog or cold weather or something that is just that evokes a mood to set my scene.
Now, you know, I was curious because, you know, obviously the book features real people, including yourself and your wife and things that you've actually done. And it takes place in the beginning. Well, it takes place while Foyle's War is being filmed. So.
The first chapter of the book is on the set of Foyle's War. And it's a true story, incidentally. Everything I wrote in that chapter is completely true. I should have also said, incidentally, that everything I write about my life, my writing life, my life in London, my life with my family, insofar as you see any of it, it's all true. I don't make up stuff about myself.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. So in the back, you have the acknowledgments, and I read them. And even there, I wasn't sure how much was true and how much was not, because you mentioned people that you consulted. Are they real people, or are you acting as a character in the acknowledgments?
In the acknowledgments of a sentence's death, I think only one character is given a false name, and that was because he requested it. The transport police helped me. I did go to the British Transport Police in order to find out what happens when somebody falls or is pushed underneath a train, and they were very helpful. But when I asked if they wanted an acknowledgement, they gave me a false name to put into the book, which I did. But the two cavers, for example, I mentioned, I did go caving in Yorkshire, what we call pot holding, and I think you call spillicking. Mm-hmm. I did that in Yorkshire and acknowledged the two people who helped me. But then I also, rather to my own amusement, having been helped by two real cavers, I then put them into the story as characters as well. So they have sort of a double life in the book.
Under their real name?
That is right, yeah. I asked their permission first, of course. I didn't want to upset them, but they were very happy to take part.
Wow, that's
And it was true that the character called Dave, I forget his surname now, does do cave rescues, and it's an extraordinary job. You know, these people are volunteers, and if you get stuck underground in a cave in Britain or anywhere else in the world, because these people are all over the world, they will come out at a moment's notice to sort of yank you out and rescue you.
Oh, wow.
It was funny that I wrote this book just months before that extraordinary event happened in Thailand with all those children getting lost in a cave, and I thought, oh, gosh, how prescient is that to have a murder mystery set in a pothole? Incident at exactly the same time that the whole world is watching one on TV.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Oh, and it's called spelunking here, yeah. You mentioned in the book that you have a contract for a third book about Daniel Hawthorne. Do you, and will we get to know more about Hawthorne and the secrets he has?
My plan is, actually, all being well, and assuming that the series continues to be a success, is to write about 10 of these books. I'm thinking that number 3 is called The Killer Question, and number 4, The Knives Are Out. I actually have contracts for 2 more now. My publishers were optimistic enough to ask for another couple of them. And I think, for me, a lot of the fun of it, and I hope for my readers too, will be to discover what it is that has made Hawthorne such a difficult man and has made him so problematic and so unable to cope with many things in life. As I sit here, have about half of that answer. I have a very surprising, I would even go so far as to say shocking, resolution in mind, but it'll take me, as the narrator in the books, quite a long time to get there. And I think that the fun of it is going to be that with every book, I will add more information and new characters and more background, and gradually that picture will form, which is, of course, what writers do anyway. I mean, over the 12 or 13 Alex Rider books that I've written, I have deepened and found out more about the character of Alex Rider and that journey from sort of just being a, you know, teenage spy age 14 to being quite a sort of a dark and motivated and complex character, which he is now, has been the journey of those books. I'm doing exactly the same with Hawthorne, the only difference being that I'm doing it in front of your eyes, as it were. I'm actually searching out the information as a character in his world.
And it's terrific, and I certainly look forward to the sequels. Well, Anthony Horowitz, I just love The Sentence's Death as much as I did The Word is Murder. Thank you so much for talking with us again about these books.
It's been a complete pleasure, Francesca. Thank you so much for this call.
The Sentence's Death is out from HarperCollins. Listen to or read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. Coming up next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Christian McEwen about her gem of a book, Legal Tender, Women and the Secret Life of Money. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.